Connecticut Today for Tuesday, June 16th, featured a look at another controversial encounter recently between law enforcement and an African-American male, this one in Atlanta. It resulted in the male being shot and killed. We carried parts of Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont's daily coronavirus update, and on the eve of Phase 2 reopening in the state, we spoke with Scott Dolch, the head of the Connecticut Restaurant Association. Back here, he is an instructor, a professor of criminal justice at the Criminal Justice Program at Quinnipiac University, also a member of law enforcement over his career at various levels. Professor Kalfani Touré joins us once again. Professor Paul here again. Great to have you back. How are you?
Hey, thank you, Paul. I'm doing well, and I hope the same for you.
Thank you. I am. We're doing okay. The audience is good. Well, Professor, first, let me ask you, as somebody, I'm guessing, you may have been in a similar situation as those two officers in Atlanta were the other night of that drive-through in the Rashard Brooks situation. I'm sure you've looked at the video. What are your thoughts after seeing the video from all those angles? Give me your initial assessment of what you saw here.
So my immediate thoughts is that, you know, my heart goes out to his family because out of all of this, the daughter and the other siblings and the wife are directly impacted by his absence now and his loss. And, you know, unfortunately, I think that we must be very careful with each critical incident, how these incidents are folded into the sort of larger narrative around the need for social justice. I am not sure, in terms of the use of force, that this particular incident of use of force is illegal. I think it might be unjust, and there might have been alternative ways of resolving this issue. So I think we just have to be careful with how we roll this into this larger discussion about police reform.
Yeah, Professor, I looked at it, and my immediate reaction was, wow, there's a lot going on here. And that was my initial thought, almost what you just said, Professor, is, okay, this is a lot different than George Floyd here. And there are so many, I guess you would say, micro things going on here at once that I'm sure these are going to have to be pored over by, you know, a grand jury or a DA or a prosecutor as to how they look at that.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing is it just underscores how close we are and how dense, for example, Atlanta is a very dense city. And so how close we are as citizens, but yet how distant we are. The manager, as opposed to calling the police, could have come out of the restaurant and knocked on Mr. Brooks' window and awakened him and alerted him to the fact that he fell asleep in the drive-thru. And so the question is then, why call the police? But let's just assume that the manager thought, well, maybe he was intoxicated. There's, you know, a number of occasions where people who are inebriated will come to the drive-through and think they can get some coffee or some food, and it'll cause the alcoholism to sort of dissipate, and it doesn't. But there's other things I think that the law enforcement officers could have also done as well.
All right, Professor, stand by. We'll be back to you momentarily. We're trying to piece together, folks, look at this Rashard Brooks incident in Atlanta. A little more of a micro situation here with an associate professor of criminology who himself was a law enforcement officer at various levels in various locations, Associate Professor Kalfani Touré from Quinnipiac University. We'll discuss this further with him. First, though, coming up on 3:36, you know what the sixes mean, traffic and weather together on the sixes right here on WICC. And we continue for a few more minutes with Associate Professor of Criminology at Quinnipiac University, Professor Kalfani Touré, a former law enforcement official, too, officer. Professor, it certainly looks like that encounter was going okay for upwards of a half an hour until they tried to cuff the suspect. Are you surprised at that? Was that something that in your days as an officer that you ever encountered? Can a situation go from, I guess, almost cordial and courteous? Can it go south that quickly? Obviously, it can, I guess.
Absolutely. And obviously, there's a variation here, but it can go south pretty quickly. Most people are frightened by the prospects of being incarcerated, being placed in handcuffs, having one's mobility, one's body seized, placed in a patrol car, put inside of a jail, because they, in fact, at that point, lose control. But what I'm even more shocked about, I must tell you, Paul, is that the officers even decided to make an arrest. You know, officers are granted the ability to use good decisions, hopefully they will, but also use discretion. And I wonder what motivated this officer to decide to make an arrest in the middle of a pandemic. In other words, that the mortality rates are really high in nursing homes, elderly homes, convalescent homes, and jails and prisons. And for something like this, why wasn't an alternative such as, hey, I think you're intoxicated, you're going to leave your car here, let me give you a ride to your house.
Mm-hmm.
Why make an arrest? Perhaps he could have given him a citation and driven him to his house.
Got it.
So I question the judgment of the officer, but I do think that we have to be careful. We have to be really careful. I mean, there are people who want to reform policing, and everything in the kitchen sink will be tossed at as evidence of the need for this.
Yeah.
I do think this is an evidence for it, but I think we have to be careful with how we include it in.
Okay, so they get into this physical altercation, Professor. He gets one of the officer's tasers. You can hear the officer on the audio saying, he's got my blanking taser. Then we get this wide shot video. Thankfully, it's there of the surveillance video of the Wendy's parking lot. The suspect runs, he turns, and then discharges the taser apparently toward the officer as the officer fired. We know what happened. I guess, Professor, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I know there's a debate going on here. Well, a taser is a non-lethal weapon, so the officer should have used some discretion there. It's interesting, Professor, I had former officers call this show yesterday, and they were kind of split down the middle on this. It was a bad shooting. It was a justified shooting. Once that gentleman has the taser, do you pursue? Do you just let him go and figure, oh, we got his car, we can find out where he lives? What you've done there?
Well, so you also have that. But what we call in law enforcement parlance is that this is an awful but lawful shooting. Now, by no means am I justifying using lethal force. I'm simply saying that if this officer perceived his life and this is a less lethal force, let's just assume that Mr. Brooks was able to effectively deploy the taser against the officer. Then the idea in law enforcement without training is that if there is a potential that you can be incapacitated then the next level up is that this person can seize your firearm and do worse to you. And so in this continuum of force, once you pass, a taser, what's left then is lethal force. So with that being said, there were other possibilities. He could have maintained a close distance with him far enough so the taser was ineffective. But close enough that he could continue to pursue him and call out his location until other officers were able to back him up and they could have secured him. But I think there's something more fundamental at problem here. Mm-hmm. And that is, what are the hidden histories that come into an encounter between law enforcement and the African-American community? And unfortunately, we're not having that conversation.
And this sort of, Professor, in a way, I think you alluded to it earlier, this kind of, A, I think dilutes that conversation, and B, sort of becomes self-defeating here when we want to have that conversation.
Well, it becomes problematic if we don't understand how to strategically insert it in this call for reform of police departments. So the point is, what shaped or influenced the perception of the two officers upon encountering this African-American male? And what was the perception of this African-American male upon being encountered by two police officers? I just want to remind you, six officers in Atlanta with the Atlanta Police Department were fired for attacking two college students. And Mr. Brooks is probably aware of what happened to Mr. Floyd,
yeah.
and he's aware of what happened to all these individuals who died at the hands of police officers who arguably used excessive force.
Yeah,
and
you're right.
So Mr. Brooks is frightened, and you can see that in the videos, because it's about six of them out there. You can see that he's frightened, mm-hmm. and he attempts to elude, not to engage in a prolonged fight. He's trying to get away from them. But the officers also come to the encounter with the history of the uniform. Whether we like it or not, the history of police departments and police as an institution has been used to support very repressive policies and practices against marginal, minority, mm-hmm. and in particular African-American communities. So this history is at play. And so the question is, what would cause these two officers to determine an arrest in the middle of the pandemic or determine to use force when there were other alternatives? That's a question that we need to address.
Professor, hang on. I want to do one more quick segment for you, with you, if you can. I want to ask you, when we come back after a couple of minutes, about this theory of chokeholds and physical means that officers will be now allowed to use. So hang on, one more quick break, then we'll get back with Professor Kalfani Touré. Fascinating stuff. He's a former law enforcement official himself, law enforcement agent, and he's currently an associate professor of criminology at Quinnipiac University. Back with more Professor Touré, first Traffic and Weather together right here on WICC. And a couple more minutes talking about police processes and all that with a former police officer on several levels, now an associate professor of criminal justice at Quinnipiac University, Professor Kalfani Touré. Professor, on this notion of chokeholds, now, number one, I was surprised that I thought they were banned, but maybe I was wrong on that. I had floated a scenario earlier, Professor, and if you can enlighten me on this, having been an officer yourself, if we ban chokeholds, what if we have a scenario where it is one officer against one suspect, backup has not arrived yet, it may be a female officer wrestling with a far more physical or muscular male officer, and maybe if she gets on his back, does she have to think twice then, Professor, about using a chokehold if she perceives her life to be in danger? Or when they say there's a ban on a chokehold, does that mean if other methods of restraining the suspect should be tried first? Walk me through that. What are your thoughts on that?
So first, I just want to correct the record. I'm an assistant professor and
not
an associate professor.
I got it.
But the second thing about chokeholds, I just want to say I was really pleased to see that the president of the United States has come out against chokeholds as well. And he signed his executive order towards police reform, and which we will ideally ban chokeholds. But one of the key things that the president has noted was that, you know, unless there are conditions where officer believes that they reasonably need to use a chokehold to preserve their life or the life of some other. So I don't think that there's an absolute case closed or ban on chokeholds.
Okay.
But, you know, a chokehold simply, it was this idea to, one, you put the forearm across the front of the throat,
yeah.
and often that led to the collapsing of the windpipe and death, almost definitely.
Yeah.
And then the other idea was that you use a V-shaped hold on the throat, which will pinch the carotid artery, stopping blood and oxygen going to the brain and cause the person to collapse. You know, chokeholds have always been dangerous because they've always led to death and severe injury.
Sure.
And so with that being said, you know, I've never been in favor of chokeholds, but I should tell you, I've never been taught to use chokeholds because by and large, it wasn't a practice in the three police agencies that I worked for.
Okay.
But it's in the regular application of chokeholds around the country, I think chokeholds are bad. And I think you have to be in a really, really desperate situation to use a chokehold and to be able to justify it. Now, you think of Eric Garner. You had four officers there.
Yeah.
Was a chokehold necessary? And to be quite frank, why was he even stopped? What was the probable cause for Eric Garner, other than the knowledge that at times in the past he sold loose cigarettes?
Mm-hmm.
So it is the sort of indiscriminate use of very sort of lethal methods, particularly on people of color, that is causing the sort of long-held call for justice.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this didn't just start here. In fact, before Rodney King's situation, there was Mr. Mincy in L.A. who was killed in 1982 from a
chokehold. I remember that case. Okay, so I'm glad you straightened me out on that, because, yeah, I'm thinking to myself, why would you use a chokehold if there's four or five other cops there versus you and just a bigger suspect? You have no idea where your backup is, and you want to go home to your kids. I get that. How receptive, Professor, do you think the police unions and the locals, because that's where the rubber is going to meet the road here. I've been saying that for weeks here. How perceptive do you think they're going to be to opening up, A, their disciplinary procedures, and B, their past records of officers who may have had some problems? What do you think about that?
Well, I can tell you that the unions are going to dig their heels in about any past transgressions. And so even though they endorse the President's Reform Act today, you can be sure that it's forward-facing. It's certainly not rear-facing because, it's been common practice for unions to protect the past actions of police officers. So another thing that the unions were particularly concerned about was to make sure that past transgressions, if you will, or violations of standard operating procedures, that police officers wouldn't have that record follow them to a new agency, or that those complaints wouldn't become a permanent part of the record. In fact, I should tell you, Paul, if you are wrongfully convicted, you have a tougher time getting an expungement or your record corrected than if you are a law enforcement officer who engages in bad practices. In other words, we state it differently. A law enforcement officer is likely to get his bad practices and substantiated complaints expunged before a person who was wrongfully convicted.
Wow.
This is a fundamental problem. And so I believe that the majority of police officers around the country realize that there is a problem with policing. And I think we're at a historical moment where law enforcement is willing to be at the table and concern themselves with reform.
Professor, thank you so much again. It's been fascinating. Hopefully we can tap on your expertise again in the future. Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice, Quinnipiac University, former law enforcement officer at three different agencies, Kalfani Touré. Professor, thank you. Have a safe weekend, and we'll talk. Thank you.
Take care, Paul.
Be good. Thanks, Professor.
Where we are on COVID, then talk about some of our reopening strategy when it comes to outdoor events and cycles. First of all, the summary is the trends are all continuing in the same right path. 360,000 tests performed. That's close to 10% of our total population. Worth remembering, many people have been tested twice, so we're really a little under 10% in terms of our totals. Deaths are at single digits, tragically, but way down from where we were before, and hospitalizations continues down. I think this next chart will show you a little bit about hospitalizations, Max. What you see there is two things. You see the red line shows you where our peak was. Our peak in terms of hospitalizations, about 2,000, was on April 22nd. We're down about 90% in terms of hospitalizations since then. The yellow line you see on May 20th is interesting. That's when we did our phase of reopening for outdoor dining and stores and the such. And the good news there is I don't think we opened too early, and the trend lines in terms of hospitalizations have continued down. And that allows us to do our next phase of reopening tomorrow. This next map is fascinating. It's put together by the COVID Exit Strategy Group. And what you see is in red are those states that are, quote, trending poorly. trending poorly is reflected in terms of increasing hospitalizations, increasing positivity, percentage of those who tested and tested positive. Sadly, it's a reminder that the number of states here who are trending poorly is up compared to 1 week, 3 weeks, and 5 weeks ago. Mainly a lot of states, we talked about Arizona the other day, Texas, Florida, California is really in and around LA. These are the hot spots that we focus on like a laser beam, doing everything we can to make sure that doesn't happen here. Making progress, I think you can understand what those are about. But trending better is what I really wanted you to be able to see. That's, again, it's Connecticut, thankfully, as well as New York and New Jersey, over there, Illinois. And that means, A, our positivity stays below at about 2%, which is extraordinarily good, even a little less the positivity rate in New York, which is extraordinarily good. And it's good news for us. That's one reason we can feel more confident about opening up restaurants and the such, even though some people from New York may be coming up. They don't have a high infection rate. They have a low infection rate now going forward. So testing, we're still in the top 10 overall per capita in terms of testing, a way to go. But I think that's another reason we're in the green, one of the positive states trending in the right direction. And, of course, our hospitalizations continue down as well. And finally, this next chart, it's a little complicated, but it's the rate of transmission. And what that says is if you're infected, how many people are you likely to infect? And that means that if you're below one, obviously the footprint for COVID is shrinking because for every person infected, you're not infecting another person. If you're on the red side of that graph, that's not a place that you want to be. New York and New Jersey, if anybody has, this is an eye test, by the way, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, that blue arrow, you can see have the lowest transmission rates in the country. And we were just thinking about what does that mean? Maybe it's because we got hit with COVID earlier. But then we looked over, we saw Washington State, WA, is there in the red, for example. You know, that was hit even before us. I'm not going to overanalyze this, but I am going to tell you these are the type of metrics that we think about very carefully when we talk about reopening, how fast we can reopen, and the fact that New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut are more likely to be wearing the masks than some other parts of the country is making a big difference. Finally, I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about reopening starting tomorrow again. I think you know, and David has given you a good detail in terms of what we're doing in terms of indoor dining, since outdoor dining has worked pretty successfully over the last 4 weeks. Hotels, I said before, we feel more confident, even people from out of state coming in now, certainly from our region, which has a low positivity rate, low infection rate. The personal services, we've done the hair, now we're doing the nails, now we're doing tattoos. David, you'll be happy about that. So we're getting some progress here in terms of a lot of what we're doing to get 95% of our economy up and operating. Outdoor, people ask me about a lot. And what are your protocols there? Why do we have rules about outdoor? I see thousands of people protesting, and yet I can't have a graduation or I can't have a big outdoor barbecue in my backyard. What's going on and what's your rationale? So starting tomorrow, first of all, for our personal space, our private gatherings, you can have up to 25 people indoors and up to 100 outdoors. Let me tell you what our thinking was there. That's up from 10 indoors and 25 outdoors under current structure. First of all, when it comes to these social gatherings, you're more likely to be interfacing with people closer, maybe drinking, less likely to have a mask. That's on the negative side. On the positive, they tend to be invitation only, or you know everybody who's going to be there. So if there was a flare-up, if somebody was found to be infected, track and trace is a lot easier to manage. So we thought this was an appropriate place for our inside private gatherings to be and our outside private gatherings. So that's a big change. Maybe New Jersey is a little more ambitious on that front. You know, Massachusetts and New York, Rhode Island, sort of comparable to where we are in that space. July 3rd, we're going to add on a few other metrics. As you know, for graduations, we're keeping that at 150. That's probably July 6th. I don't think he'd be doing that July 3rd. And Deirdre and David have been working on this. Of course, it depends on your cohort. So if you have a group of 150 over here, and you have a group of 150 in another part of the football field, you have some room there to maneuver. But that's what it is for outdoor graduations. We're also thinking about big organized outdoor events. We have something called July 4th coming up, and the fireworks. And believe me, we've had good, vigorous discussions about what is a way to deal with the way that we celebrate our nation's independence and do it in a way that it doesn't promote the infections. And we're learning from what we've done at the beaches and the parks, limiting parking a little bit, but more importantly, keep your social group 15 feet from other people. That's the way it's working on the beaches. Put your blanket down, watch the fireworks, stay with the group that you've been hanging out with for a while. You know they're safe, they're like your family, and keep space 15 feet amongst those around you. I think that's a way that we can maintain our social distance and be able to enjoy the fireworks in a real way. And we're gonna work with the organizers in terms of capping the overall group at, say, 500. So we just don't have a big mass gathering there because we're not sure who, if it comes to track and trace, we'll have a better idea of who you were in contact with. That's what we're doing for the outdoor organized gatherings. Then we have event venues, amphitheaters, racetracks, and the such. And they're opening as well at 25% capacity, just like we're doing at museums and other facilities. And finally, we had a discussion, frankly, about what should we project about going forward a month or two from now? And you see how the world has changed in the last month. You can make a case, why do we project anything at all? It maybe leads to a false confidence, or you could have a flare-up like you've seen in a lot of those red states. Why do we want to give people an idea of what it looks like? Well, so you can plan, so you can have some idea of how we're thinking about events going forward, so you can plan accordingly, comma, be wary, because if the metrics change, if hospitalizations scoot up, if we have these flare-ups, we'll have to, change course. That's just reality. But so what we are thinking about is, going forward in mid-July, we'd have bigger outdoor gatherings, say 250. And again, following the same social distancing protocols. And that gives you some indication about private gatherings as well, like a wedding and the such. So those are things that you can plan accordingly, knowing that there's a fair amount of risk. Sadly, my daughter Emily postponed her wedding just because she had too many friends that said, look, there's a good chance you're going to have this wedding, and I'm really positive about what's going on in places like Connecticut, but there's also a good chance it may not, and we've got to make a deposit on the plane and the such. So we're holding off. But I wanted you to get the best idea of how we're thinking about these outside gatherings and what type of progress we're making together, assuming the metrics keep going and we maintain our social distancing. With that, Deirdre and David, you can add something, or maybe we just take some questions from people. I think it's questions.
Channel 3 Eyewitness News. Channel 3 Eyewitness News, unmute.
Waiting for the question period to begin here, live on WICC with Governor Ned Lamont as we head into phase two tomorrow.
The question is about the DMV. Residents are asking us about priorities, waiting for the DMV to open so they can get their licensing. While the nail salons and amusement parks are opening up, is the DMV ready? Customers and agents are sharing the same space. Is the ventilation upgraded? Is the airflow improved? Those are the questions people are asking us.
Well, I can start on that, and then maybe David could help me out, or anybody. Weathersfield, Cheshire, we are opening those up by appointment only. We have a backlog of people who are waiting for their driver's tests. We're working with some private contractors to see if we might be able to answer some of that load, obviously wearing the mask accordingly. And finally, for DMV, as you know, we've delayed the time that you have to renew your license and other things that maybe were going to take you into DMV, just so we could prevent against a rush to DMV, but they are opening.
Yeah, I'll just add that DMV is working on bringing additional services online next week, so starting to phase back in road tests. The knowledge tests have been continuing in a more limited fashion, but they're also working on some creative approaches for how we clear the substantial backlog of testing that has built up over the last 3 months. So the team's working hard on that. A lot of the services are online and are available now. If you have questions, go on the website, and you'll start to see even more services coming online next week with all the same protocols that we're implementing based on public health and occupational safety guidelines. You'll see a lot of plexiglass in there. You'll see a lot of markings on the floor with one-way traffic and spacing and all the things that I think people are getting used to at this point.
Thank you.
I'll add as well, this is one of the things that DMV, under the leadership of Commissioner Magyabani, is know before you go, and this is the perfect example during this time to know before you go. Go to the website, call ahead, have an understanding of what are the services you need to be done, but also know that other providers who are DMV partners, whether it's the Connecticut credit unions, as well as AAA, are providing services as well.
Thank you.
NBC Connecticut.
Good afternoon, Governor. Last night, the Windsor Town Council approved a resolution declaring racism a public health crisis. I was just wondering your thoughts, if you'd had any discussions with Senator Anwar about his ask to have a state declaration.
Well, I'm happy to have that discussion. Not sure what a state declaration means, if I can issue a lot of new executive orders, but I do know that this pandemic has revealed the racial disparities. And I think we knew this before, and it's really brought it home. The fact that if you're black, you're twice as likely to die, much more likely to die, much more likely to be infected, comorbidities. And this has just reminded us how we have to deal head on with the racial disparities as well as the healthcare crisis we have.
And with hotel workers in the state, they delivered to you a petition asking to strengthen health and safety guidelines for the hotel and lodging sector, including like mandating hazard pay for them. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, we work closely with the hotels as well as the labor to make sure that, workers felt safe going back to the hotels. We set very clear protocols in terms of what they have to do in terms of infection standards and the such. And like it is with all of our businesses, it's really important the hotels maintain those standards to give confidence to customers so they're willing to go back as well.
Do you have a number of the businesses that have self-certified? And if they don't self-certify and open back up, what the consequence of that is?
David?
Sure, I'm happy to take that. Yeah, so to date, over 15,000 businesses have self-certified. You know, we estimate between 30,000 and 40,000 businesses shut down during the pandemic. So we'd expect to see more as we enter phase two. What we saw in phase one is not all businesses are going to open on the 17th tomorrow. So we expect it to happen over the coming weeks.
And then my last question, there is a West Hartford salon asking customers to sign a waiver, basically that they won't get sued if the customer gets COVID-19. Are there any protections for businesses that you're considering enacting? I believe the Reopen Connecticut Committee had made a similar suggestion much earlier on.
I don't think so. We've set very clear protocols in terms of how a nail salon, hair salon, restaurant have to meet those protocols. I think that provides them a certain amount of, protection, but just a certain amount. We've been careful on that. I noticed to go to a Donald Trump rally, you have to sign a waiver as well. So people are trying to avoid the risk. But I think most importantly, because David came up with a clear set of protocols, if any employee, any customer feels uncomfortable, doesn't think they're being followed, there's a 211 hotline. You can go report it. We'll be able to respond immediately as well. I think those are the protections you need.
News 8.
Hi, Governor. Stephanie Simone here. I had a question about the fact that the state is hiring an outside firm to investigate nursing homes and how the Department of Public Health responded to this pandemic. What kind of violations could facilities see if they are in violation? Could staff be punished if they didn't follow proper protocol?
Well, I'll start on that, but we just did an event about the nursing homes with the bipartisan women's caucus from the legislature. Very helpful. And you're right. We were early on in the nursing homes, as you know, in terms of stopping visitations, inspecting all of them. Now we've got a third party that's going to specialize in this, respond to our request, go to each and every one of these nursing homes. Want to see why there was such a differential. Some had zero infections. Some had very, very, very high infection rates and fatalities. What were the moving metrics there? We want to make sure that we get it right if there is a second surge going forward. We want to think long-term about our nursing homes. Are there penalties and consequences? Absolutely. Some of these nursing homes have been fined already, and they operate under regulation of a Department of Public Health, so we'll be watching this carefully.
That was it. We haven't stopped since.
Also, when could we see results of the investigation? How quickly?
Do you know that, Jeff?
Yeah, the plan is to receive interim recommendations and feedback by mid-August with a target of a final report by the end of September.
If everyone could please mute your devices if you're not asking a question, please mute your devices if you are not asking a question. Thank you. Next to Fox 61.
Good afternoon. This question is for Commissioner Layman about social clubs. We've had a couple of viewers write in about where they fall, obviously in phase two, but are wondering if social clubs also host weddings, are they allowed to follow the recommendations and the guidelines of, you know, social distancing, reduced capacity, and holding weddings at those different venues?
Thank you for the question. So the short answer is for weddings, that type of gathering is going to have unique guidelines to it, and we are expanding and increasing the capacity there. But for that type of event, that's going to have a specific capacity restriction, which is separate from, for example, the restaurant or the pool guidelines that we have out for social clubs. Just as the governor mentioned at the outset, the nature of that event and the commingling and what we view as the risk of transmission at that event is different. So for social clubs that are doing their normal course business, they'll follow restaurant guidelines again and pool guidelines. But for specific outdoor events, they will need to be subject to those caps and the outdoor event guidance that we provided.
And that would be the same for social clubs who act primarily as bars?
So social clubs, again, if it's primarily a bar, or if it is a bar, that's not able to be open until phase three. Offering a dining experience and food with the alcohol has been something that we've felt strongly about as we've opened up these types of institutions. So for social clubs that fit that bill, they should be able to open in phase three if it's a bar, but phase two if it effectively serves as a broad social club with other activities as well.
And Governor, a quick question for you too. We have so many people that are flocking to Connecticut's beaches now that the weather is nice and warm. Do you know when the bathrooms will be open at the beaches? We're getting a lot of questions about restrooms.
Now, aren't they? Aren't we opening those up now? Let me get back to you on that. I think it's overdue.
Thank you.
News 12 Connecticut.
Listening to live coverage of Governor Ned Lamont's daily coronavirus briefing, the question
WTIC
period.
WTIC 1080 News.
All right, tell you what, we will jump in
Connecticut
there.
Connecticut Public Media.
Many people apparently are not asking questions today. So there you go. You got it from Governor Ned Lamont as we try to bring you every day that the governor does one of these as we prep for the phase two opening tomorrow. Various topics we discuss with him regarding the restaurant and service industries concerning food. Tomorrow, a big day. Scott Dolch joins us. He heads the Connecticut Restaurant Association. Scott, Paul here. How are you?
I'm good, Paul. Thanks for having me.
And I can imagine that this is a day tomorrow. It was going to be on the 20th. The governor moved it up a few days to keep it away from the weekend. Another step, Scott, toward getting the industry that you folks at the CRA represent back on its feet.
No, it is. It is. It's a big day. It's a big step. Our restaurants have obviously been waiting for this day for definitely a few weeks now. We're excited that it's finally here and get this opportunity to start to open all of our restaurants back up and obviously make people feel safe and get us back on this path to recovery.
So we're talking, Scott, what, basically about 4 months? It escapes me what the exact shutdown date was, but is it about 4 months or so that many of your restaurants have not been able to do sit-down dining?
Luckily, it hasn't been 4 months, more closer to three. Okay. March 16th was the shutdown date, but it's about 94, it'll be about 93, 94 days since that point, which I think we'll hit here tomorrow. And it's been a very long time, feels a lot longer for especially these business owners. No one has experienced this, obviously, and having to close their business for this length of time and getting back to some sense of normalcy like they have with the folks that have been able to do outdoor dining for the last, we've been 4 weeks now of open with outdoor dining, and has gone well for the ones that have been able to. And I'm hopeful for the same here with everybody on indoor dining tomorrow.
You know, Scott, I'm glad you mentioned that because I drive around and where I live and I see it took a while. The tents went up. I'm like, well, not a lot of people. Then all of a sudden, Scott, you know, as soon as the weather turned a little bit and the nights were kind of a little warmer, less breezy, all of a sudden I started to see a lot of people eating under these tents, you know, well into the night.
Yeah, and Paul, you're right. I mean, consumer confidence is a big part of this whole discussion and getting people to feel comfortable coming back out. You know, things are, you know, safe. I think our industry we've talked about is a leader in safety and sanitation. We've always been that way. You know, there's no other industry where public health comes through your industry on a quarterly basis to make sure you're doing those things. And we're going above and beyond. And I think outdoor, you know, the first week or so is just getting our bearings and getting our restaurants back on their feet, getting that consumer confidence built up. And the weather has definitely been extremely helpful for us to just have outdoor only the last 4 weeks. If you look at, you know, 70, 80 degree weather and consistent like another great day today. But I think indoor, you're going to see the same thing. These restaurants are continuing to take this to heart. Public health and safety is our number one concern through this for their employees and for the customers. And, you know, we want you to have a little of that sense of normalcy again to dine out. And I think indoor will be very similar, hopefully, you know, to outdoor, building that consumer confidence.
Scott, what will people notice if they go back to their favorite restaurant that they haven't been to for the better part of 3 months, at least eating inside? What are some of the things that they will see when they walk through the doors?
Sure. No, I think it's for those of you that have gone out to outdoor dining so far in this pandemic, it'll be very similar. Obviously, we talk a lot about it. It's about controlling your environment. We can control it probably better than anybody else. And when you walk in, obviously the employees will need to be wearing masks, and the servers will continue to have to wear gloves. And you'll have to wear a mask as you enter, whether it's indoor, outdoor seating. You know, you'll be escorted to your table. You'll get a chance to sit down, whether that's inside or outside. And you'll keep that 6 foot spacing from the nearest table around you. And you'll be able to take your mask off to dine in. Obviously, the employees won't have that opportunity, but that's part of this and keeping people safe. But they'll have that same experience that they had outside. They'll have inside. They get up to go to the bathroom. They have to get up to maybe run to their car for something or whatever that it might be. They'll have to put their mask back on and protect themselves, their own guests, customers, and employees by doing that. But, you know, you'll see a little bit of that also in phase two, which we appreciate the governor and Commissioner Lehman here to allow for bar seating. With a little bit of restrictions, but you'll be able to come and sit out at a bar if you want to come out and dine out. I know a lot of singles and couples like to sit at the bar, but there are some restrictions. But with those restrictions, obviously, that you have to put a plexiglass barrier up if you have a bartender behind the bar servicing. But, you know, as you guys know, going to, you know, a Lowe's or a Dunkin' Donuts now or inside, you know, the plexiglass barrier is a little bit of commonplace, but to have a sense of being able to use that bar space for seating is important for our restaurants to get back to this 50% capacity. They can't pick up and move it. So we worked very hard to talk about a dining service for a bar seating just like a high top table. And that'll be the experience people will be able to do. But I think, you know, you'll see a lot of similarities. You know, you won't see a lot at your table when you get to your table in the sense that, you know, rolled silverware, plates, everything will be mm-hmm. brought really to you to keep that safety and sanitation feeling that's there. Because obviously we want to continue to protect people through this process and make sure our restaurants are keeping you safe.
And Scott Dolch, by the way, is the guest for a few more minutes. He heads the Connecticut Restaurant Association. Scott, I know that you've probably been in touch with a countless number of restaurants here and people who represent the restaurants, small and big. Unfortunately, Scott, correct me if I'm wrong, there are restaurants that might not be able to make it through this or may have already said they can't, correct? While others were on a little bit more of a firmer financial foundation to make it through this?
No, it's a great question, Paul. It's something that I struggle with in my position every day and lose sleep at night. You know, I think we've heard stats out there from national stats that as high as 25% to 30% of restaurants might not make it through this pandemic, you know, and you look at 8,500 restaurants and just back a napkin math, you know, close to 2,000 restaurants in our state could not make it. It might not be able to make it. And I hope those numbers are really high projections and aren't accurate. And that's what we're trying to do everything we can, because every restaurant is dealing with their own challenges of reopening. Could they get outdoor dining? You know, what do they get from federal loans? Do they get a PPP loan? Do they get an EIDL? What else is out there that's helping them through this pandemic? And then as they look to reopen, we also know, you know, the normal population of people coming in to eat out is not going to be the same initially. It's going to be that consumer confidence. So I am very much worried, you know, of making sure. That's why we are working as hard as we can as an association to help every business, every restaurant, and answer their questions, find them help, find them resources to get them through this, because it is a difficult time. These restaurants have had to kind of pivot. We use that word a lot, the pivot, and reinvent themselves a little bit more than usual because, you know, of the times that we're in and how to, you know, still be in a sense, make some dollars to offset the debt they've carried and making sure that they can continue on and be a viable, profitable restaurant for years to come and continue to support their local communities like they do so well.
And Scott, I also read in a strange way, I read a piece over the weekend that some restaurants are actually, I don't know whether benefit is the word, but they're kind of using this as a learning experience, seeing about, you know, paring down menus and moving forward, you know, what's been popular in carry out dining and trying to use this almost as almost kind of a new angle of marketing here to see other ways they can actually grow their revenues over the months and maybe looking at their businesses, Scott, as they never did before.
Yeah, you make a great point, Paul. I think that's something that I talk to with all of my restaurants, you know, whoever calls them, obviously my board, my extended members, even if you're not a member, every day about the fact that, you know, you kind of have to pivot. You have to reinvent yourself right now. You have to think of, you know, things you might not have thought before. And these are people that maybe have had a restaurant for 30 years, 40 years and said, this is the way I've always done it. And, you know, I've never done takeout. I've never done curbside before, or outdoor dining. I don't have that opportunity, or didn't before. Like, where I've had to have some honest conversations with folks to say, listen, even getting inside tomorrow is a great thing. It's a great step, but it's still a step. And, you know, there's other avenues that you have to look and get creative with, you know, whether it is your menu, if you've got a gigantic menu of paring it down, or what the trends are. You know, people still are a little hesitant, but hopefully they're still supporting our local restaurants any way that they can. And takeout and curbside is a part of that. It has been for 10 weeks now. And at the same time for outdoor dining, you know, I said, hey, listen, the governor has issued an executive order to allow you to add outdoor dining if you've never had it before. You've got about a 4 or 5 month window here to be creative with that, you know, for the time being, to get some of your seats back that you might not have had inside. So all of that is honest conversation. I think you're right that restaurants are really reinventing. They're entrepreneurs at heart. That's what our industry is. They're fighters, and they're figuring out creative ways to survive. And that's what my hope is, to kind of be their support here to help them survive this.
Well, Scott, pass along our good wishes to your members, and we'll have you on to the future. You'll keep us up to date with this. Scott, we appreciate it. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks for the time, as always, and keep supporting local restaurants, as I know you do.
Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it. Scott Dolch, who heads the Connecticut Restaurant Association.